This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we learn about the Bambi buckets carried by helicopters in aerial firefighting operations. In the news, the wreckage of a cargo jet that made a water landing is located. Richard Branson flies into space, or close to it. The F-35A wins a Swiss competition, and Germany buys the P-8A Poseidon. But China isn't having a lot of success exporting their fighters. We have thoughts on supersonic transports, unruly passengers, and defense training for flight attendants. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 661 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and of course, he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Max, great to be here with you, and I'm really excited because it looks like we've got the band back together tonight here.
We kind of do, and maybe the drummer, the guy that keeps the pace going, David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert, is here with us.
Hey, everyone. I don't want to belittle this, but to everyone who reached out to us over the last week about Brad, thank you for taking the time. I know that we're having trouble keeping up with all of the emails and stuff, but we miss him, and we will figure out a way to honor his name, and we do appreciate everyone who's reached out to us.
And quite a large number of you have done just that, and it's really been wonderful. We're collecting the comments, and I hope to give those to Launchpad's wife, Gabby, in a little bit. And we're also actively working on a donation source, an organization that you can make a contribution to in Launchpad's name and Brad's name. So we'll be having more information about that shortly. But we have one more introduction to do before we get to our guest, and that's Rob Mark. He's with us. He's the senior editor of Flying Magazine, and he's the publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening to all of you guys. It is nice to be back with part of the band. And before we talk about anything else, I just want to offer listeners my apology that I could not make it I couldn't join you last week when you recorded that great episode about Brad. So as a mea culpa of some sorts, there's a story coming out tomorrow in Flying's E-News that is all Brad-focused, and it was my particular version of how I remembered him, and I hope people enjoy it, because he was a funny guy. You knew him, and you talked to him, and he asked a bunch of goofy questions, and he just was always there. And he went, okay, what's Launchpad got now? Like that part you guys recorded about him saying, Rob, where's Rob? Yes. I just thought that was hilarious. But, you know, he is really going to be missed. And I think that's what I tried to capture was some of the some of my thoughts and feelings about what it's like to lose another friend. And so anyway, if you don't get it, listeners, rob@jetwine.com, and I'll make sure you get a copy of it. So, all right. Again, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's good to have you, Rob. All right. Well, let's introduce our guest for this episode. It's Sergio Fukamati. He's the aerial firefighting director at SEI Industries. They make the Bambi bucket systems. Now, SEI Industries is an industrial fabric products producer. They were established in 1978, but they're best known for these Bambi bucket systems that are used in aerial firefighting operations all over the world. Now, these are they're lightweight, they're strong, flexible firefighting buckets. They were first introduced in 1982, and they've become an enormously successful firefighting tool. In fact, the Bambi bucket's now used in over 115 countries by more than 1,000 helicopter operators. But as for Sergio, he has over 25 years of international business management experience. He's a professional engineer. He's a registered project management professional. And Sergio has led the aerial firefighting division at SEI Industries in Delta, British Columbia, since 2017. So, Sergio, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for this opportunity. Great to be here with this team from Airplane Geeks and your audience. And it's still good afternoon from the West Coast here in Delta, in the greater Vancouver area. So nice to be here.
Well, we're very pleased to have you. It's probably worth mentioning that Launchpad Merzari was instrumental in working with you and being able to bring us the story of the Bambi bucket. So let's jump right in and talk about that. Sergio, can you describe for us what is a Bambi bucket? And obviously, one of the first questions should be, why is it called a Bambi bucket?
All right. So you have already mentioned in a nutshell during your introduction about the Bambi bucket. But Bambi bucket, to be simple, explain what it is that big orange bucket that you see slung under the helicopters when they are on an aerial firefighting operation. So used to pick up water from any water source down on the ground and lift over and drop on the fires. So it's a flexible, fully collapsible water bucket and made of a special industrial fabric and here in Delta BC and produced in many different sizes and models. And today, being used by most of operators and military forces around the world that are in the aerial firefighting application.
Sergio, you mentioned that they are available in different sizes. Maybe tell us a little bit about what that size range is and what are the different applications for the different bucket sizes?
Well, the size range from 72. Do you prefer gallons, U.S. gallons, or liters? But
let's go with gallons.
Gallons, okay. It's 72 gallons from the smaller one all the way up to 2,800 gallons. And, of course, they are spread out in the different sizes according to the different capacity of the helicopter. So the smaller bucket for the small helicopter and the largest bucket for the largest helicopter.
And what's the process for filling them with water? I think that there are maybe a couple of different types of Bambi bucket systems that employ different methods of filling the bucket with water.
Yeah, sorry, before going to that question, Max, if you hold that for next, I forgot to answer the first question, which is about the Bambi name. So I don't want to forget about give you a little a note on that regards. I mean, there are many a few stories that I have heard out there about the origin of the Bambi name, and one of them being the Bambi comes from the Disney deer character there, and the Bambi was made to protect the little animal in the forest. The other story that people hear a lot is about that Bambi was actually the name of a waitress working on a pub in Boise, Idaho, where the firefighters used to go and hang up there for a happy hour. But when you ask Don Arney the true side of the story about this name, Don Arney is the inventor of the Bambi bucket, and he has a totally different story, of course. And this goes back to 1987, when the bucket was already being started the production here in our facility. And so he was interviewed for a hoster on the CBC television here named Bob Fortune. And they became friends. And then Bob took him for dinner one night and said, "Hey, Don, you know what? You have to have a name for this product." And so Don didn't want to to get too serious about it. And then just as a joke, he said, oh, call it Bambi Bucket. And so Bob accepted the name, and then he said, okay, let's review that. And he put a list of pros and cons of keeping or not keeping the name. And story short, yeah, that became the name of this product. So when you ask Don about it, he said, yeah, the name comes from that dinner that I had with the Bob Fortune.
I like the one about the waitress better. I just think it has more. It's
yeah,
more.
So that, I think that's the most popular one, yes.
Yeah, then everybody wants to know, do you have a picture of Bambi? So is this Bambi Bucket a complimentary name or not, perhaps? But anyway.
Yeah, regardless of what the story is or which one you like, it's a name that you don't forget once you hear it. It kind of sticks.
Sergio, can I just dovetail off the next the last comment about the sizes of the buckets? Yeah. Do you determine the gallons by the weight of the water or that the helicopter can lift, or is there just a specific reason why you picked water's heavy for all intents and purposes? So, is that the reason why the different levels of the bucket is the weight of the water?
Yes, to be honest, I don't know how the whole decision about whether weight or volume, but of course, when you design the bucket and you calculate the volume of liquid that goes inside of that particular bucket, so and then from there you start with the classification of the different size according to the volume, and then you convert either to gallons or liters. And all the numbers and the models of the bucket is related to the actual, to the number equivalent to the gallons, U.S. gallons of water. So the last two numbers of each model is going to be to represent the number of gallons multiplied by 10.
Very good. That makes sense. That makes it easy to identify.
Correct.
So, Sergio, tell us a little bit about how the buckets are filled with water.
The simple way is the most used one way is to bring the bucket, the helicopter will fly the bucket over a lake or a river or a swimming pool and dip the bucket into the water, so the bucket will turn sideways and sink immediately, and then the helicopter will fly out of the water with the bucket full. That is the most used approach. If the bucket does not have any additional accessories to work as a power fuel accessories. And so then we do have different alternatives of doing that. There are a snorkel pump that can be installed on the side of the bucket to pump water from shallow sources of water. So by using those pumps, you don't have to look for, you don't have to have a deep source of water, as long as you have a minimum of approximately 18 inches of depth, that's good enough for the pump to get in and start sucking the water into the bucket.
And I could see that that could be important if, like you say, if the water source is shallow. So maybe you have a river that's not very deep, some other a small pond. Someplace
Correct.
Where you do have water and enough of it, but it's not deep enough to submerge the entire bucket. The helicopter, I assume, would be hovering while the water is being sucked into the bucket in those cases.
Correct.
I've got a two-part question about that. You said the Model 2800 is 2800 gallon capacity.
That is 2,800 gallons capacity. Yeah.
So,
and it's equivalent to 10,000 liters of water. It's almost, it's 2,600 U.S. gallons and 9,800
okay.
liters.
So that's still 14,000 pounds U.S. If I do the calculations roughly. But what kind of a machine would carry a weight like that? David's probably the one to answer that, but I don't know helicopters.
The one I see flying the most is the largest bucket are the Chinooks. Some Chinooks in North America and some Chinooks, like the Dutch Air Force, they have several Chinooks. And they are one of our oldest customers using that particular side. Not many are flying those buckets, but they are.
And how long does it take in a lake, let's say, to fill a 2,800-gallon bucket? I mean, I'm just wondering how long the pilots they're hovering.
Rob, if they go for a deep source of water in a lake, for instance, they're going to sink the bucket. I mean, it's only the time for the bucket to sink in and then lift it up, so it's very quick. Wow. Now, if they're using the pump capability because of the depth limitation, then the pump, for that size of a bucket, our pump has it's a four-pump unit system. And so they deliver a total capacity of 1,800 gallons per minute. So that is the flow speed to fill up that bucket. So, Wow. Yeah, somewhere between 1 and 2 minutes hovering to fill it up.
David, maybe you're a good one for this too, but when a helicopter is carrying a load like that, that's hung from a sling of
slung load.
Some sort. Yeah, what is the...
It's what they called sling loading.
Sling loading, okay. Yeah. So what that must change the flight characteristics quite a bit.
Absolutely, especially on a Chinook. One of the things when you become a pilot of like a Chinook or a UH-60 or a Huey, you have to go through specific sling loading training. Usually you also have to have an observer on the helicopter to be able to watch the item being hung underneath. Something is the size of the 2800 on a Chinook probably is not just slung from the center, but has supporting lines to other parts of the helicopter, so it doesn't really sway. And it's an intricate process. You've got to observe the thing, and you've got to make sure that there isn't lateral swing across the helicopter, as well as, you know, moving parallel with the helicopter as well as against the helicopter. So sling loading is not an easy thing, but almost all military helicopters are capable of doing even minimal sling loading. I mean, from UH-1s up to Chinooks, and even the V-22 is capable of sling loading an item. And eventually, I'm sure we'll see V-22s doing firebombing also.
Well, how about that kind of training in this case with Bambi buckets? Sergio, does SEI get involved in providing the training, or does your customer handle that on their own?
The customers, of course, they can handle on their own, and we don't have internal capability or resource to do like the train for the flight and the helicopter operation part of it. We do offer to customers the repair, maintenance, and operation of the bucket itself. So every customer is welcome to come here to our facility in Canada and go through a 3-4 day training process when they are new to Bambi buckets. And we work with a few operators out there that are in the business of providing training on operation of sling load, long line operations, and vertical reference type of operations, and training pilots for the overall aerial firefighting operations. So, yeah, that we refer our customers to those partners.
Sure, that makes sense. Sure. Sergio, what kind of material is used for the buckets? And you mentioned maintenance. What kind of maintenance is required to ensure that these are operated safely and effectively?
As far as for the material, the bucket is manufactured out of a engineered industrial fabric. The base fabric, it's made of nylon polyester type of composite material. And then it's overlaid, it's coated with urethane on the outside. It's a very, very robust and strong, high-strength fabric. So then, of course, it's designed according to the shape and the configuration and the volume and the size. So panels are cut in specific dimensions, and they are welded together using radio frequency welding technology.
So I'm wondering, what was the state of the art prior to the Bambi bucket? In other words, were helicopters used prior to its invention, and what did they use before there was a Bambi bucket?
Oh, that goes before a long time ago, but the idea of dropping water from helicopter probably came before even Bambi bucket, but it was Don that came up with this unique idea of developing this bucket that became what you talk about now, the Bambi bucket.
You know, I was trying to imagine the 2800 again, just because, or 2600, I guess it is, because of the size. But how far beneath the helicopter is that thing hanging, typically?
Typically, I think on the larger helicopters, what I have seen is a 200 feet long line.
200
wow.
feet.
I'm just imagining a big bucket with, you know, 10 or 12,000 pounds of water hanging 200 feet beneath the helicopter. There must also be some kind of wind limitations in which you can use that bucket, I imagine, right?
I'm sure, yeah. Of course, the slinging bucket will restrict the flight speed of the helicopters.
Well, I guess I was thinking that you wouldn't want to get that bucket, maybe in turbulence, bouncing around or moving side to side or anything like that. I'm just curious if maybe there isn't a limitation. I don't know. But again, that's why I'm not a helicopter pilot.
Yeah, neither am I. But it's quite stable when you see, even flying empty, the flight is quite stable, and of course, when it's loaded, it's a quite heavy load under the at the end of that long line. So it's going to be a very stable flight.
I think I'd still like to watch it from the ground myself.
Well, not directly beneath it.
Well, no, of course not.
Speaking of which, Sergio, tell us a little bit about the mechanism for releasing the water or controlling the volume of the release, the speed with which the load is released. How is all of that handled?
The first Bambi bucket, and actually it will turn 40 years next year in 2022. So it was invented and conceived in 1982, so 40 years. And the first one which is still I think the most popular one that we have in the market. It's one single drop, meaning when the pilot put a trigger and the whole load of water is displaced at once. And that valve it's made of also of fabric. It's a sort of udder that will collapse out when the water is being released. And then as soon as there is no more weight, so the electromechanical mechanism at the bucket control head will pull back that udder inwards, and then it will close. And then with the weight of the water, it will squeeze that valve and seal, so the water will not leak until you go to the next drop, and then you release that control cable that will displace that udder down again, and the water is going out. It's an ingenious but simple process.
Those are the best solutions, right? The ones that are the simplest and therefore less likely to fail in operation.
Yeah, and when you go back to your previous question that we didn't comment about maintenance, I mean, there are a lot of small components and adjustments that need to be done to make sure all the functionality of this valve will take place in the correct way. So how they replace those strings, how they adjust the tension, and on the control head, so it's an electromechanical system with a spring reel and solenoids and the locks and lock mechanisms and cables. It's a quite complex piece of equipment.
And you certainly don't want the water to drop out when you don't intend it to, when you're not over your target. Right. I mean, you want it to be, it needs to be incredibly reliable. Is there, or are there any regulator certifications required for this kind of equipment, for the Bambi bucket?
No, it's actually, there is no need for STC. As long as it is slung down the outside the helicopters, there is no requirement for STC.
Go ahead, Rob.
Well, I'm thinking of the logistics of this whole thing, and as a pilot, I mean, other than Max, you can probably get this. I mean, imagine flying and then losing 12,000 pounds of cargo in 2 seconds on a machine. I can imagine a helicopter jumping back up into the air. But when the bucket is again, I'm thinking of the worst fires that I've seen on the telly, and I how close would a bucket get to the fire in order to, or how close does it need to get to the fire in order to be really useful?
That's a very good question, and to be honest, I don't know precisely how far from the fire the buckets are, but they are flying. Of course, the closer you get, probably you're going to have a better concentration of water on the drop, and the further up you are, so there will be more dispersion and evaporation of the water, right? So, yeah, it's a trick control from the part of the pilot to make sure he's getting on the right altitude from the fire. But then also there is speed of the helicopter, right? If he can fly and on certain speed, he's going to create like a stream of water dropping during the period of that valve being opened. But on that line also, going back to the previous question, I mean, this is the single drop bucket. And then later on, SCI has developed a few models with a multi-drop capability. So this bucket is way more complex, and it has a gated valve that can be controlled from the trigger by the pilot or the operator upstairs, and can be opened several times. So one load of 2,600 gallons can be dropped in several operations according to the magnitude of the fire, according to the operation itself. So if they are on at the end of the firefight, where they're going to after the hot spots, and they want to drop a little bit of water here, a little bit of water there, so they will use that capability to, with the same load, make several drops.
Interesting. And it's not several compartments, each dedicated to a particular drop. It's still one bucket of water, but what you're doing, you're controlling the drop quantity by the use of these valves. So, yeah, that's fascinating. I can see how that's and is that a relatively new development, or has that been around for a while?
No, that has been around for a while. I mean, some models have been developed with that capability, have been replaced by new development, but keeping in mind the same requirements. And more importantly, this is a safety feature for helicopters operators, because it gives the pilot the capacity also to shed water as he's loading on the first time. So if he's at the beginning of the fuel cycle of the helicopter is a little heavier and he doesn't want to lift the full bucket, so he goes to the dip, fill up with water, and then he can shed some water out before flying out, and then he can control the maximum load that he's lifting at that point.
Is there a way for the pilot to know how many gallons are left in the bucket for those multiple drops?
No, it's just by his feeling and in terms of how much load he's flying with. And now to answer further your questions, we do have in development, and we are testing right now, actually, this product in Spain. We have developed another version of we call that the Bambi Max. That's the trade name for this multi-drop bucket.
Good name.
And,
I like it.
Bambi Max. Yeah, good name. And now we're testing the IMAX, which is Intelligent Max. And so this equipment has a touch screen display that goes with the operator on the helicopter or installed on the cockpit of the helicopter. And on this touch screen, the pilot can also program the volume he want to lift, like 70% of that capacity. And then he can also program how many drops he's going to make, 1, 2, 3, 4 drops. And then once that is done, on the trigger, he's going to control every time he's going to be doing what he has already set on the screen. And so with that type of control, then he will have an overview of how much is left on the last drop or what he has programmed the that particular drop to be.
That's fascinating.
It is, yeah. And we see it on the news, right, with all the fires that seem to be occurring each year with greater frequency. I don't know if that has represented a growth in your volume or your customer base, Sergio, or with the increase in wildfires that we're seeing, are more companies or more organizations getting into the firefighting market, or is it just the same group of folks and their utilization is going up? How's that impact SEI?
No, it's the business, I mean, is being growing steadily. And yes, and I think, of course, much to do with the volume of fires, not only in North America, but all over the world. And before, they used to talk about the fire season and a certain time of the year where we'd be firefighting out there. But nowadays, there is no more fire season, and it's a throughout the year type of operations. And many operators, they are becoming multinational operators. So in one season, they are firefighting in North America, and then on the low season here, they're going to move their assets to South America or to Asia, and they're going to be firefighting there. So we have seen an increased number of operators and helicopters on the area firefighting community out there.
Max Trescott, you're seeing lots of fires on your side of the country. Are you seeing a ramp up already this, quote, season?
Well, here in California, we've already had a few fires, none as big as we had last year. One of the things I was intrigued to learn when I interviewed the California Air National Guard last year about a rescue that they had done was that they really seemed to be, at least in the summertime, in the full-time firefighting business. I had thought of National Guard helicopters as being used for, you know, other kinds of things, but it really sounds like they are doing a lot of the heavy lifting here for firefighting in California. So a lot of different agencies involved, including the National Guard.
Right. And we have all the other products which is related to the line of product related to air firefight, which are the ignition spheres, which is fighting fire with fire. And that is, it's quite a popular technology and a family of products that we have developed and been used by the same group of operators that are firefight with the buckets.
So, wait a minute now. So you're fighting fire with fire? How does that work?
Because you know the expression of the back burn. So when the fire is going to a certain direction and they want to go back on the other side and start a fire from there, so that fire comes and meets the other fire and then they kill it. And to start that fire, you need to ignite fire. And we have a product line which uses a ignition spheres that's been dropped from the helicopters, that when it drops the ground, after a few seconds, it will start a combustion and burn that little sphere that will start fires in any fuel that is available down the ground.
So those are the dragon eggs?
The dragon eggs.
What a great name. I really like that.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't know that existed. And that sounds a lot safer than deploying people out to light those fires, those backfires. I mean, that's got to be a really dangerous job. So if you can accomplish the same thing by dropping these from a helicopter, what a great solution.
Yeah, and also quite used for the controlled burns that they do before the fire season, when they already map the area and they see where there is a very high concentration of potential fuel for wildfires to get out of control. So they go there in a different time of the season and they do a controlled burn of that material, so to reduce the risk of very intense high fires during the fire season.
Very cool. All
dragon right. Eggs. I've got to remember that term.
I know that's pretty
good. Don't ask about the dragon, because I still need to do some research about how that story comes.
Oh, no, we already figured that out. She was a bartender in a small bar in Boise, Idaho.
Yeah. Another one.
And a different one. Yes.
But she was hell on wheels. You never wanted to cross her.
Yeah. All right.
No, let's face it, that was the shots Bambi served in the bar.
Oh, the dragon eggs. Oh, yeah. You know, that would be an interesting name for a really potent drink. So you think you're a big guy?
Yeah.
Let me see if you can handle a dragon egg.
Yeah, fantastic. Sergio, if people want to learn more about Bambi Buckets and SCI Industries, where's the best place they should go?
Well, the best place to go is our website, SCI.ind.com, and all the informations and all the product manuals and technical bulletins, and they're all there. There's amount of information available for everyone that wants to learn about that product.
And we'll of course put a link in the show notes to SCI Industries, to their website, but we'll also have some videos, some from SCI and some others, that illustrate how these works. And it's not just pure helicopters, right, David? We see at least one instance where V-22 Ospreys were used with Bambi buckets, which seems like another aircraft well suited to that.
Absolutely. The V-22 being a vertical takeoff and landing and the ability to hover. Any vehicle with the ability to hover, okay, not an F-35B, but that you can sling load, it is a perfect solution for a Bambi bucket. And the nice thing about this technology is, in the past we've talked about MAFIS, which is the mobile firefighting systems that you can load into like a C-130 or other aerial firefighting systems, where the ability of the aircraft to fight fires is built in permanently. The Bambi bucket solution does not really affect the rest of the usage of the helicopter. I mean, the sling-loaded Bambi bucket is one of those added technologies that you can just put on the helicopter, like a UH-60 in the Air National Guard, in the National Guard, and use it as a National Guard helicopter. But when you have firefighting seasons, and this even occurs here in New Jersey, the New Jersey Air National Guard uses Bambi buckets to fight fires in the Pine Barrens. But the rest of the year, they're just flying normal UH-60 missions. So it's a wonderful technology that just adds to the capability of a helicopter.
Fascinating. So, yeah, we encourage you to take a look at some of the videos and some of the information that we'll have in our show notes. And maybe next time you're watching the news and you see an operation being covered at a wildfire, you'll know that you're looking at a Bambi bucket, perhaps, and you'll know a little bit more about the Bambi bucket and what's behind them. So, Sergio, we really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us, and we like exploring kind of little nooks and crannies of aviation, and firefighting with Bambi buckets is one of those areas. So it's been really instructive, and we want to thank you.
Well, thank you again for this opportunity. Nice to talk to you and your audience, and hopefully you have learned a little bit about the Bambi bucket. And we're here to help you next time.
With that, we have some aviation news from the past week. We'll start off with a story about the Boeing 737 cargo plane that went down. Max Trescott, we have a little bit of an update on that.
Yeah, this is one of those rare occurrences. I think most people know that one of the benefits of flying multi-engine aircraft is if you lose an engine, then you have other engines to help get you going. It's very, very rare to have double engine failures, but one of these did occur. It was an older Boeing 737, not the newer Boeing 737 MAX that's been having issues. And it was a cargo jet which took off from Hawaii. And it didn't get very far. They were literally only just up a few thousand feet, just a couple of miles offshore, when they called in to announce that they had lost the number one engine and that they were coming back straight to the airport. And shortly thereafter, they said that there was a chance they were going to lose their other engine because it was, quote, running very hot. And that turned out to be exactly the case. They asked the air traffic controllers to let the Coast Guard know. And the controller said, yes, they had already been notified, and these two gentlemen were picked up off the aircraft after it hit the water. Now, this occurred about 2 o'clock in the morning, and if you think about it, if you're going to do a water landing, you'd like to be able to see the water.
Yes.
So I'm hoping, since they were pretty much headed toward the shoreline, that they had some type of visual reference outside, perhaps from lights from Oahu, which would have been just, you know, a couple miles in front of them. Otherwise, it would be extremely difficult and dangerous, I think, to let down on the water, because you wouldn't necessarily know your height above the water. You wouldn't know when to start to flare. So they were probably very lucky that it occurred so close to shore, because they may have had some visual references. And what you referred to, Max, is the update. The NTSB has found the aircraft in, I believe, about 140 feet of water. So they are looking to figure out how they could recover some of the black boxes from that aircraft.
I saw one story that said that it was around 400 feet down. So I don't know what's accurate, but also that they use some interesting technology to find it. They use a side scan sonar and a remotely operated vehicle to find it. But that, at least according to this source at Reuters, the plane remnants are too far down to send divers. So they're trying to, figure out how they're going to approach that.
I can't imagine it. I can't imagine a scarier situation in an airplane than ditching, period. I mean, especially for seaplane pilots, they understand that relationship of that last 10 or 15 feet before you touch down in the water. But at night, oh my gosh, I mean, I would think that it's pretty much get it set up as best you can and cross your fingers. Because I think hopefully what Max said is probably true, that they were at least facing the shore or headed toward it, because otherwise they're IFR. You can't tell up from down or left from right. But they got out. I mean, that's just, I can't wait to hear the story. Dual engine failure? Sounds like something in, I know I'm going to get beat up for supposing, but it sounds like a fuel issue to me. Because usually if one dies and it's not a fuel issue, the other one doesn't die. But for the other one to go under, it doesn't look good. So, but at least they got out in one piece.
Well, though, they were injured, one more so than the other, which is not surprising. I mean, you can just imagine, a 737, you could probably slow it to about 120, but that's still darn hard to hit the water at that speed.
It is.
You're not kidding.
Well, they went down, but Rob, Richard Branson, he went up, didn't he?
He did, and for anybody that was free yesterday morning, it was quite an event. I honestly didn't know about it until my daughter mentioned, "Hey, Dad, are you going to watch that Branson guy get launched into space?" And I said, "Yeah, when is that?" She said, "Oh, looks like about 10 minutes." And I went, "Huh?" So it was indeed pretty cool. The fun part about it is I pulled it up on my laptop because the feed I was watching on CNBC put their logo right in the upper right-hand corner of the screen, and it covered up the instruments so we couldn't see how high they were or how fast they were going. But then once the Unity broke free, it was just, they were going through 10,000 feet in about 3 seconds. I think they got up to about 170,000 feet before the fuel ran out. But it was really cool because of the technology with which we were able to listen to the people in the cabin and watch the technology give us updates on what the aircraft was doing. And I thought it was pretty impressive. I realized he's a billionaire. He built the thing or he paid for it, and he should get a ride. But still, I thought it was pretty cool considering the fact that the U.S. government really doesn't have a direct, you know, link to that sort of thing anymore.
I think by going up himself, Richard Branson is making a pretty strong statement about his belief in the safety of the system, which, I mean, I know he's got a waiting list of potential customers. In fact, I read just today that Elon Musk, who I understand was kind of there watching, but Musk has put down a deposit himself for a future flight.
But think about that. I mean, I forgot what they said the tickets are going for now, a couple hundred thousand a piece or something. And someone says, do you happen to have a couple hundred grand you could use for about a 2-minute fun roller coaster ride? Oh, yeah, here. Sure. Do you want it in cash? But hopefully someday, maybe after half of us are gone, this will become more common as people have a chance to look at space from up close, past the, you know, be able to see the curvature of the Earth. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but if they'd offered me a ride in the shuttle, I'd have gone in a minute.
One of the things I thought was kind of interesting was just the use of the logo. You know, there's a great photograph that shows the aircraft separating, you know, the two of them separating at about 46,000 feet. And on the bottom of the Unity, the space plane, the most prominent thing you can see is the words Virgin across the bottom. Now, the thing kind of looks like a frog because part of the body isn't really visible. And you see these, it looked like two big legs hanging out from the back of it. But it really is kind of remarkable that they figured out how to make this show up so well from the ground.
Oh, but let's face it, that was the most expensive publicity stunt that anybody has seen in a long, long time. I still think it was pretty neat myself, though.
Do you think they'll start selling advertising on the bottom of the space plane?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I would be surprised if somehow Richard Branson didn't figure out a way to turn an extra buck or two. Maybe it'll be the cabin dedicated to Microsoft or something, or who know, or Google, or who knows what.
The thing's remarkable to me is you experience zero G for 5 minutes. It's like, whoa, that's a lot of money for 5 minutes of zero G time.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you think that goes quickly, or do you think 5 minutes at zero G just seems to last forever? I'm not sure.
I think it's 5G. It's 5 minutes at zero G sounds awfully nauseating to me.
You know, and I hadn't even thought about this. For example, you can buy zero G here on Earth by signing up for, I forget the name of the company. Everybody calls it the Vomit Comet, which is an airplane which simulates it, and you get much shorter amounts of zero G. But I'm wondering, did anybody see in the Virgin Galactic space plane, did they unbuckle when they were zero G? Were they floating around in the cabin?
They were. If you watch his statement before he went flying, the other people that were aboard were bouncing around the cabin while he was making his statement about being a child that wanted to fly and dream big and, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. Richard Branson being Richard Branson. But yeah, he, and there are still photos of Branson floating in the cabin.
You know, you may have an opportunity to float in that cabin yourself because Branson announced a partnership with OMAZ, that charity fundraising site, and you can sign up for that. And you can donate if you want, but it's not, I guess it's not required. But if you, well, all the donations are going to go to Humanity for Space, which is it's a nonprofit. And the drawing is for two seats on a Virgin Galactic commercial flight. So we'll have a link in the show notes to this site where you can sign up if you want. The drawing closes September 1st, 2021, and they're going to announce the winner, quote, around September 29th, 2021. But yeah, no donation is required. And they have several categories of donation levels that get you different numbers of entries. So if you donate $10, you get 100 entries. If you donate $50, you get 1,000 entries. And if you donate $100, you get 2,000 entries. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. I don't know. Do you guys think you'll sign up for that?
Yeah, I'll do my $10, and you only need one winning ticket.
That's true, but of course, look at the lotteries, David. I mean, I'm convinced that the chances of winning the lotto are about the same whether you buy a ticket or not. But you know, I might be wrong, but you're right. You only need one.
It's pretty close.
But think about this: at least this isn't an ultra low cost carrier kind of situation where they're going to jam, you know, 70 people into one capsule. Although, That is an interesting question, is that as this ramps up, will they build larger aircraft or will they jam more seats into this one or
just reduce the seat pitch?
Yeah, reduce the seat pitch. Yes.
And do you really want to go with the low-cost space plane carrier?
No.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, NASA's been saying that for years. Do you getting strapped to a ballistic missile that was built by the lowest bidder? But, you know, one thing that I didn't hear come out of this was that it's only been 2002 was when Spaceship One won the Ansari Prize, which VSS Unity is based on. You know, Spaceship One was the first one to go into orbit and earn astronaut wings. And I don't remember hearing Richard saying any thank you to Bert for the technology. And Mr. Rutan, it's his bird, you know, and maybe a larger version of it, but it still goes back to our good old friend Bert Rutan, who has changed aviation multiple times and keeps changing aviation.
Well, and just imagine if the gentleman who runs Ryanair, Michael O'Leary, gets involved and has the low-cost space plane. You know, I can see that your flight into space might only cost you, I don't know, say $1,000. But if you want to reserve a seat, well, that's an additional $50,000. You want to bring any water with you, that's an additional $100,000. Oh, you want to bring your camera? There's another $50,000.
Well, and the laboratory will be outside of the spaceship.
Right. That's exactly where I was going, David. I mean, it's just it's crazy, but this is a different era of space travel than we've ever been used to. I mean, sure, the shuttles had all the problems they did, but it was run by the government. There was no, you know, money changing hands, at least visibly. But this is all 100% corporate profit based. So who knows what we're going to see?
Exciting times. Well, at least exciting times for those who have enough disposable income to play with their money and get some spectacular rides.
Yeah, you'd have to be somebody really important, like a Vision Jet instructor, to be able to afford you know a ticket on the Unity. But you know, there's not that many of us.
All right, a little bit of military news we see from Defense News. Lockheed's F-35 topples competition in Swiss fighter contest. So, David, this was, well, the Swiss are looking to replace their old Hornets, I think, right?
They're, believe it or not, they're looking to replace their Hornets and their F5s. They still have some F5 E's, which believe it or E's and F's, which believe it or not, were the very last of their line. But that was up against what seems to be the common theme these days, which was it was the Eurofighter, the Rafale, the Super Hornet, and the F-35, and only one of those was a fifth-generation fighter, and surprisingly, the Swiss came to the conclusion that the cheapest out of the four of them was the F-35, which we find it hard to believe, but there also was the added benefit. They were also getting some Patriot batteries for self-defense. Now, Swiss is a neutral country. It always has been. It was never allied with NATO, nor was it allied with the Warsaw Pact. But it is higher technology being transferred over to Switzerland. And they've made their use of their F-18s for years very quietly, much like the Finnish did. You know, they sort of had F-18s and just they purchased them, they flew them. But so this is a broadening of the spectrum for the F-35. But 36 of them going to Switzerland. Personally, it'll be kind of cool watching them operate from mountainside hangars like the Swiss do. You know, they like hanging their airplanes from ceilings and then taxiing them out of mountains and flying them away. So, and these are straight F-35As. There's no extended wings or vertical takeoff, right? They're also getting the associated weaponry that goes with it, you know. And the other story that we have is it looks like Boeing has got another victory for their P-3 replacement. Germany is going to purchase the P-8 Poseidons to replace their aging P-3 aircraft. It looks like that process of the P-3 Orions going away, being replaced these days by Poseidon aircraft, you know, which is a Boeing 737 with a bomb bag or a torpedo bag. And so, I mean, those two stories are major purchases by countries, but for Lockheed, it's another. It looks like the F-35 is rapidly becoming the F-16 of choice for the rest of the world for a fifth generation fighter. And the irony, of course, though, is, you know, all of us complaining about how expensive they are, the Swiss found that they were the cheapest option. So we'll see.
These P-8s going to Germany are under the foreign military sales process, the FMS process, which probably a lot of folks don't know about if you don't follow, you know, military aviation too much. But I mean, David, you can chime in. But FMS is it's a U.S. government program, and it's a way to transfer defense articles and services and training to others, international organizations, international partners.
And that goes for all military purchases, not just aircraft. I mean, anytime you are transferring military technology, it's going to go through that process. We know what's being transferred and how much is being transferred and what's the technology involved there, because we don't want certain technologies to get into the wrong hands.
There's another, maybe just a quick mention, a story in foreignpolicy.com. This is the world doesn't want Beijing's fighter jets. China, of course, would love to become a major exporter of fighter jets, but they're not really seeing a whole lot of success in that. There's some interesting statistics, some data in this article, which talks about sales, export sales between 2000 and 2020. And over that time period, the United States exported $99.6 billion worth of military aircraft. 99.6. Russia exported $61.5 billion. France exported $14.7 billion, while China only exported $7.2 billion worth of military aircraft. So they've got a ways to go before they could be considered a major exporter of fighter jets.
And that's kind of, you know, we talk about China being everything, you know, we buy everything from China these days, but they are lagging behind, you know, and trying to catch up. But there's not really the demand because it's sort of saturated by the major powers already. Like Pakistan worked with China on making one of their newest fighters, but they do not have the sphere of influence yet for military equipment that the rest of the Russians or the United States or Great Britain or France have, but that have been developed over so many years. So China's got a ways to go with that.
Yeah, it does. Quickly, there's an item at WBUR.org. Does supersonic flight have a future? And this comes from NPR's Here and Now. And I have mixed feelings about this piece. They're talking about, you know, the current crop, if you will, of supersonic transports being developed. But they make some sort of odd statements in this piece. They characterize the Concorde as being that plane that ultimately proved to be a flop in the marketplace, which is, I don't know, that's kind of a...
Which is true. It was an economic failure.
Well,
it was an economic failure. While the accident occurred, causing its demise to go away sooner than later, the cost of fuel and the cost, it was not a technology at the time that was causing the maturity of the technology, causing the prices to go down. The Concorde got more expenses over time and was not finding, and not fewer and fewer people were able to fly on the vehicle. So, I mean, that comes back to the next supersonic transport is who's going to be able to use it, and will it become an effective way to fly relatively inexpensively? You know, the Concorde was for the jet set. That's why they called them the jet set. They were flying on jets before everybody else. But, you know, I mean, yes, it was able to take Phil Collins from Wembley Stadium to JFK Stadium in 1984 for Live Aid in both stadiums. But that being said, the Concorde was not an economic success for either Air France or British Airways.
I agree. I mean, it just wasn't. It would have been nice if it had been, but it just didn't work out that way. I mean, it doesn't mean that people wouldn't fly on one or think that it's pretty snazzy. But again, can you get enough people to fly it regularly and operate the airplane in such a way that you can make a profit on it? Jury's still out. I mean, you know, we lost Aerion last month for the business aviation side, and now Boom is the big new kid on the block, and United has an awful lot of faith in them. But again, we're going to find out in, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, something like that, if it actually works.
Yeah, I agree. If you look at the numbers, I knew they were small. I couldn't remember them exactly, so I looked it up. Only 20 Concordes were ever built. 6 were prototypes. So only 14 were actually used commercially. If you think about the many billions of dollars that were spent in development, that was definitely a money loser, I think, for all the countries who were involved, and as well as the airlines that operated them.
Well, I guess left in Concorde's legacy are enough lessons for those others who are, you know, trying to develop supersonic transports.
And if you want to hear that answer in Arabic, you can listen to me on Al Hira from last Friday. I was interviewed specifically about the X-59 and this topic of the Concorde. And that was pretty much my answer, but if it's much more entertaining in the original Arabic.
Do you know what the name of that public, what was it called?
Al Hira. A-L-H-U-R-R-A.
Do you know what that means?
I thought it was a made-up name, somewhat like Al Jazeera. Yeah,
how do you know it doesn't mean something like David's a big dummy?
Well, probably. But you know what? In Arabic, that would sound amazing. So I'm good with it.
You're probably right.
And one of the comments was from my significant other's father, who said, it was incomprehensible in either language. So I took that as a compliment.
That's hilarious. That's really great.
So that's what this...
That's quite a review.
That's what this link is, David, that we've got here? That's you on the...
That's me on the Al Hira network. Yep, live television shot.
I guess I should... watch more than the first 20 seconds, because I thought it was a joke.
You know, when I sent you an email, I said start at 8 minutes in.
That's what this is. Okay, well, I'll have to do that. We'll have a link in the show notes. So do you actually appear on camera?
I do. Yep, I do. It was filmed in our new model room at the museum.
I
did not look as well as Rob does when he's on, you know, Fox News, but you know what? It wasn't a bad hit.
But you know what? Those were back in my younger days, because, you know, as you get older,
they don't ask you back.
The TV camera no longer likes you. So,
well, the best part was listening to the simultaneous Arabic translation, and unfortunately, they put David's English down at a lower level, so it was pretty hard to hear that at all. But I figured henceforth, whenever we greet David, we should do it in Arabic. So, David, masalam.
Yeah. Oh, boy. All right. So,
what does that mean?
Means hi, David.
Oh, masalam is hello in Arabic.
Oh, okay.
All right. So, this is a TikTok. You know, I don't know what TikTok. Well, I know what it is, but it's a clock.
It's a clock, isn't it?
So there's some relationship between someone on TikTok and some duct tape.
This is a terrible story. And I think I said in the notes that if we wanted to skip it, it would be fine. I'll tell you, this is, yeah, I know. It's just bizarre, because I kind of titled it New Use for Duct Tape. We have talked a lot in the last 6 months about the ill behavior and the actually the violence on airliners, something that we've never really known before in this country. And we're seeing all kinds of bizarre, aberrant behavior. And this latest case, which was on American Airlines, a woman was apparently trying to open the front door while the aircraft was in flight. According to the story, she was apparently biting, spitting, and attacking flight attendants, prompting the crew to, quote, take her down and duct tape her, not only to the seat, but also to duct tape her mouth as well. And the person who videoed this said that he thought that the incident was not handled well. And yeah, I would agree. Duct taping someone's mouth, that may have gone a little bit too far in my mind. You know, certainly when you pull tape off somebody's mouth, you know, it's, you know, you might end up getting some skin on the tape as well.
You get rid of that unsightly mustache.
God. You know, I'm sorry. I completely disagree with that, because anybody that – I mean, I know – a flight attendant friend of mine at Southwest who knew the lady that got socked a few weeks ago and broke her front teeth. I mean, I'm sorry. And these are women, which everybody says, well, women deal with conflict much better than men. It sure doesn't look
like
it.
Yeah,
they win it. But I mean, again, what is
– Rob@jetwine.com.
But what is wrong with these people that the only thing they can do is to think of socking somebody in the jaw or doing something? Maybe part of the briefing should be, and if we do need to exit the aircraft, there are two overwing exits. And by the way, the doors don't open in flight. So don't waste your time.
I got to tell you, this is actually one of the reasons that I have been reluctant to go flying on the airlines. Certainly the concern in the past was, hey, you might catch something. The odds of that have gone down dramatically. But now there's just such a level of violence on the airplanes. You really start to wonder, is that the biggest risk that one now faces when flying the airlines? Certainly dying in an airplane crash, there's zero chance of that these days. But getting involved in an ugly, violent incident, that's certainly a lot greater chance than being in an airplane accident.
And it really is kind of amazing that, I don't know, since January or late last year, this has seemed to exponentially spike. I'd love to know what the psychology is now about all of a sudden this occurring, or there's something going on there that I just don't know what it is, or it's just kind of weird.
I think there are a lot of mental health issues right now, many of them undiagnosed. Yeah. But hey, Rob, your wife works in that field. I mean, has she said anything about the rise in mental health issues over the last year?
Well, I think, as she has told me many times, we're still operating in the dark times. We just don't know it, because there's probably going to be fallout from the last 18 months that people in her profession haven't even figured out how to measure. And people are just anxious. They're striking out at odd times, and they're just displaying odd behavior. And of course, this isn't just happening in airplanes. We've seen pictures of people. I saw one on the news the other night about a bunch of people that had a fight at Chuck E. Cheese. I mean, because is it alcohol that sets them off? Is it something else? But it's just people are just losing it. And we don't know when they're going to get it back.
And more than 3,000 incidents of unruly passengers since January 1st. So I don't have what the original numbers are, but the fines by the FAA, they are just halfway through the year. They fined three times as many people as they fined for the entire year last year. So that says, a 6x increase in FAA fines. So that's a huge increase.
In all fairness, that's really sad about last year, because even half of what's happened this year, nobody was flying last year. So, I mean, that's a really kind of a scary concept.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're now seeing people charged with felonies for their behavior on the airlines. And I think that was pretty rare in the past.
Well, but maybe that's what it's going to take for people to get the message. As we were looking at the story, one of the stories here earlier, I saw that the lady that did knock the flight attendant's teeth out on Southwest got fined over $50,000. And she, of course, got banned from flying on Southwest for life, which is just great as far as the Southwest employees are concerned. But again, there are probably a lot more people out there that are like that. And what will get them to slow down?
Well, we have a related story. And
yes.
I found these two totally separately and didn't even connect them at the time when I proposed them. But this story says that the TSA will resume defense training for airline employees. So that's what may be slowing down the amount of bad behavior. So apparently the TSA has offered self-defense training for airline flight attendants and pilots in the past. The classes were halted last year because of COVID-19. They are voluntary for flight crews. They were created after 9/11 because, of course, in that terrorist event, the flight attendants were the very first people who were killed. And they felt that they would like to have some way to protect themselves. And so this is, I guess, in one training class video, the flight attendants practice moves on a dummy targeting vulnerable areas such as the eyes, ears, and groin. So all I can say is, disobeying an order from a flight attendant may get you hurt in the future.
Well, and one comment that I really liked about it was that Sarah Nelson, from the Association of Flight Attendants, who's been a guest back in, I don't know, you guys are better at that, said that, you know, she took the training and she said, I think the course ought to be mandatory rather than voluntary. I thought that was an interesting insight.
Yes.
Well, the big difference, of course, is that the up on the flight deck, the officers are allowed to carry guns. Back in the cabin, the flight attendants are pretty much on their own.
I wonder how many pilots actually do carry guns.
Yeah, we haven't heard about that in a long time.
No.
I'm not even sure how we'd get the info, but the flight deck officers program or flight deck firearms, I forgot what that was called.
Yeah, I think we hear it occasionally when, you know, something goes wrong. I think every once in a blue moon, one of those officers will leave the gun behind or will show up in the wrong place or something like that. But they're in locked containers, so even if someone comes across the container, they're still not going to have easy access to the weapon inside.
You know, speaking of things we've not heard in a long time, the beginning of this episode, Mr. Trescott said it felt like the whole gang is here. And you know what I've heard in the background of Rob Mark's microphone? Our
cicadas.
Old friends, the cicadas.
I completely forgot about that.
It took me a minute to figure out what the thing was I was hearing. But like it or not, our old friends are back.
Yeah.
Rob's cicadas.
Guys, you want to hold it down out there? I guess they've noticed you, so...
Well, what I had said was that the band was back together, and it sounds like Rob's got the cicadas on percussion.
The percussion.
His background singers.
Whew. Boy, oh boy. That brings back some memories.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, you know, I was talking to someone. I'm not even sure what the sequence of thoughts were that got me to it, but I went back and found the Rainbows and Unicorns episode.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It's something like episode 64, or I forget
what
it was.
Wow.
It's that long ago. And I know we have some longtime listeners that remember those days. And let me tell you, it was really a different kind of a show than what we typically produce now. And I'm not so sure we shouldn't get back to some more of that old time fun. So it was kind of an eye opener. If you really want to go back, and you haven't been listening for us to us for that long, Rainbows and Unicorns. It'll I don't know. It might change your perception of us.
Yeah, Daniel was just a young pup. He was so much more naive then.
No, he says that about you too, Rob.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. Well, I've looked it up. It's episode 82. That's long before my time joining this show. Tell us more about what that episode was like, because as I read the description, I'm not getting the sense of what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, it won't be in the description. It's in the banter, which is somewhat more casual and jocular than you might hear these days.
Yeah, be truthful, Max. I mean, Dan Webb used to just pick on me relentlessly.
Oh, he knew
and now all of that work has fallen on David's shoulders, and it's just not fair. I mean, we should have somebody like Dan back.
Yeah, we'll have to work on that.
Max, you need to go, Trescott, you need to go listen to it, then you'll understand, because it is kind of funny that every June, it comes up on my Facebook feed as the number one photograph that was made, which was a drawing when our boy Dan left. It was a picture of all of us sketched, and in the background of this console of Dan standing around, there was a bunch of rainbows and unicorns, and it was a constant theme that we talked about was, you know, Dan's belief in rainbows and unicorns and cotton candy.
All right. I still have that original.
Do you really?
Yes,
is it? Do you have it as a JPEG or something?
No,
or?
I have a physical print of it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So. I'd love to get a copy of that. I'm sure I had one, but I've long since lost it.
Yeah, no, I've got them. I'll try to dig them out when I get back home.
Okay, what was the episode? 85?
82.
82.
And was it on papyrus? Because I know you guys have been around a long time.
No, it wasn't that bad. It was feather quill and paper. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Because right. I know I'm the youngster here on the show. So.
All right. We have to move on.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Of course. Our new listeners are not going to know what we're talking about
completely. Yeah, but it's worth going back to 82 to find out.
Yeah. It is.
So it's Tuesday night, Wednesday morning at 0300, a little over 48 hours after Launchpad's passing. I've been texting with someone who's been very upset about losing him. Someone on the other side of the world from me, and someone who also never met Launchpad. I'm trying to make her feel better, and I start to think, what would Launchpad say or do? Now I've got to tell you something before I go any further. To those of you that know me, it won't come as any surprise, but if you don't know me already, you need to know I have a strange and warped sense of humor. It comes out at odd times, often expressing emotions that I'm feeling in an odd way, but can be perceived as quite warped. These warped comedic sensibilities actually run in my family. Some of it was cultivated from my mother, some my father, some from both. Maybe it has to do with the books I read growing up or the films I would watch. Some of that included Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, and of course, the Marx Brothers. Just to name a few. And crazy as it seems, I also grew up loving British comedy that goes back hundreds of years. I always wanted to write a paper tracing British comedic history from Shakespeare to Gilbert and Sullivan to Noel Coward to Monty Python. Truly, I love them all. When you look at some of those influences, you can see that tragedy often becomes comedy. Think about the story from Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, The Mikado. It's all about a town that's going to be destroyed unless someone, anyone, is beheaded in the next 30 days. Doesn't sound humorous to me when described that way, but it's hysterically funny, and also includes some of the most wonderful music and lyrics you will ever hear. My warped sense of humor has gotten me in trouble on more than one occasion. In particular, it used to get very scary when my brothers and I were together as kids, and as adults for that matter. Like I said, it runs in the family. I remember a particular Passover Seder, a truly solemn event in Jewish households, an annual dinner that retells the book of Exodus. For some reason, a passage from the Haggadah, the book used to run the Seder, well, it just cracked me up, and both of my brothers just lost it with me. We couldn't stop laughing. This embarrassed my mother and father as we had company, but eventually, my folks saw the joke too and were laughing along with us. Then there was a time when my father died, and my two brothers and I went to shul to meet with a rabbi, a man we'd never met before. We needed to talk to him about the service and his eulogy, and my brothers and I just got hysterical with jokes about my father. I mean, we were all laughing so hard we were falling out of our chairs. For example, when the rabbi asked us if my father had a favorite prayer, at the same time we all said the Hamotzi, which is the blessing that's recited before meals or eating bread. The poor rabbi didn't know what to make of us. So why is that? Why do I sometimes laugh at tragedies? I don't know. Sometimes I cry when I'm extraordinarily happy. I think it's just a matter of expressing emotion. Joni Mitchell explained it in the lyrics from her song People's Parties on the album Court and Spark. Part of those lyrics talk about this woman Joni sees at a party she was attending, and they say, one minute she's so happy, then she's crying on someone's knee, saying, laughing and crying, you know, it's the same release. So with that in mind, and with all good intentions, while I mourn my friend Launchpad, like I was mourning my father when I broke up laughing, I've got to share some thoughts with you that I hope will make you smile. As I was texting my friend about Launchpad the other night, and unsuccessfully trying to comfort and cheer her, I reflected back on all the hours I spent on the phone with Launchpad. How he loved to tell me stories about what he was doing, what happened during the week, what his plans were that were coming up, and what stories he was working on for the Airplane Geeks. So I started thinking, if Launchpad were to call me right now, what would he say? And then it hit me. Now, please, again, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, nor sacrilegious, nor crazy and out of my mind. But I really think I can hear Launchpad speaking to me. I'm sure I know exactly what he would be saying. He'd be rambling on. Damn, Micah. The Fuckwolf is wrecked. It's never going to fly again. I can't believe I took all that time and effort to get it into the USA and now it's permanently grounded. It's wrecked. I mean, it's just not right. I was sure they could rebuild it. I mean, I know I brought it down hard, but those houses were coming up and I didn't want to hit anyone. Damn it. I can't believe I wrecked it. Jeez. And Gabby, you know how sweet she is. She hasn't said anything, but I think she's pissed at me. You know, I finally talked her into moving to Texas with me from Germany, and now I'm headed back to Germany to be with her parents. I mean, she came all this way, packed up the dog and the bunnies, and now I have to move someplace else. That's not just fair to her. I mean, yeah, I'll be moving in with her parents back in Germany, and I do like them a lot, but... Oh, and did I tell you? I'm going to be neighbors with Baron von Richthofen. Yeah, the Red Baron. Can't wait to invite him over for a real Texas barbecue. But let me tell you what happened. I was flying along, and the damn engine went kerflooey, and I was trying to figure out how and where to bring her down. In fact, I need to write this up for the show. This is going to make a good piece. I need to get to work on that. And after he finished telling me the whole story for the third or fourth time, Launchpad would say, "You know, I just got here and only just found the phone, so I figured I'd call you. But I gotta figure out who's in charge here. I want to get this written down and recorded for the geeks. Did Max give you the deadline for the Labor Day Bits and Pieces show yet? I hope it's not until Sunday before Labor Day. I mean, I really hope that I have that Labor Day weekend. I mean, I have plans for that weekend. I think von Richthofen is going to take me flying. Yeah, I should be able to get it worked out by then. I just got to find out who it is I need to talk to for permission to get the story to you. I'm sure I can talk them into it." And he would go on and on and on the phone like that for hours until he told me the whole story over and over with an ear-to-ear grin on his face the whole time as he weaved his tale, explaining in minute detail what happened and what he was thinking and what he did and what's coming up. That's right. Seriously, I can hear him now. Really, I can. And I think he's happy. But you know what else? And this is the important part. Even if Launchpad wasn't happy, he would still want us to be happy. I could also hear him saying something else to me, something he used to say to me all the time, something that became a cliche phrase of his when we were on the phone, one he would regularly ask me every time we talked. "So, Micah, what made you happy this week?" You see, that's just the kind of guy he was. And Launchpad, I've got to say, while you made me terribly sad this week, thinking of you now and hearing you tell me your tale in my head makes me happy. Thanks, buddy. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
All right, what's up with the geeks? Hey, I went to the Spurwink Farm fly-in and pancake breakfast that Micah has introduced us to over the years. And let me tell you, what a blast. This was an amazing, great time. Micah was there. Ernie was there. Several other people that are either characters or old friends or fun. Mike flew his Sonics in. The venue is just amazing. It's a operating farm, and so you're on this beautiful farm that overlooks the ocean, and you've got all kinds of aircraft flying in. I'm not sure what the count was this year. I think they've had like about 70 aircraft flying in the past, and they might have exceeded that this year. But good times, great pancakes. I've been to Sun and Fun, and that was great. I'm going to Oshkosh, and I know that's going to be great. And
oh,
this
you're
is going to
be at Bacon on top of it.
I'm going to be at Camp Bacon. Yeah, yeah. And this is an example. This fly-in is an example of, you know, a completely different kind of you know, social aviation event. So, highly recommend it. But Mike and I did some interviews. We'll have those coming up in some episodes in the future. But I just had a great time, met some great folks.
Pancakes. I can't even remember when I had pancakes last.
With blueberries.
Wow.
and real Maine maple syrup.
And I think that's kind of the classic general aviation fly-in. I remember when I lived back east flying into Limerick, Pennsylvania, next to the nuclear plant there, and having pancakes. And it was just a fun little flight down from New Jersey. And, you know, I never would have flown into that airport except that I'd read they had a fly-in and would be serving pancakes.
Oh, it was great. I just had a wonderful time. And it was fun, as you'll hear when we play the recordings that we made, some of the interviews. So that was my weekend, headed to the Soaring Championship in upstate New York. Actually, that's going on as we speak now, but I'll be over there the next day or two. Let's see, Max Trescott, what's been going on with you? Anything?
Well, Max, when you are in Elmira, you'll be a hop, skip, and a jump, an hour drive from my hometown of Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, which is right across the border from Elmira. So know Elmira extremely well. So have fun up there, and definitely get up to top of Harris Hill there. Great view looking down over the valley from there. And for me,
come on, it's got to be Horseheads. You can't go to Elmira. You got to go to Horseheads.
And what an interesting name for a town. I'll leave it to people to look up on the internet how Horseheads got its name. But I'll tell you this, it dates back to the revolutionary times. Let's see. So for me, I have been busy. Last week was four straight days of Vision Jet flying. And literally, these were full days. I started in the morning flying myself down to Watsonville, then flying all day in the jet, then flying back home. So long days, but great fun. A total of 9 days in the past month in the Vision Jet. And I've started posting a number of photos on my Instagram account. So for those of you who are on Instagram, go on out and search for Aviation News Talk, and you can see all the photos that I've posted there recently.
Great, great.
I like your new trend of matching your shirt with the jet you're flying. I've decided that this should be a new procedure for you, that you need to make sure that you match your wardrobe to your aircraft.
It's funny you mentioned that, because that photo of me standing in front of a Cirrus in a blue shirt, blue Cirrus, and blue sky probably got more likes than anything I have ever posted on Facebook in my life.
All right. As for you, Rob, you mentioned the story you've got coming out in Flying's E-News. Looking forward to that. That's coming out.
Well, that's right. And that's the one coming out tomorrow, which will be after this already is published. But so I hope I did Launchpad credit. You know, I hope I said something that was meaningful about him, because he was a really interesting guy. And especially, we're going to miss him up at Oshkosh, because he was a regular figure at AirVenture, and he had something all prepared for the podcast lovers up at the Pipistrel exhibit. And I don't know exactly what's going to happen now. Probably nothing, but maybe someone will pull it out. I wish I could say that I would, but unfortunately, I've got 5 days of EAA radio to deal with, in which we'll have 20 different guests on that show from 11 to noon. And if you're up at AirVenture, you can come by and peer in the window. Just don't knock on the glass, because that really makes everybody crazy. And don't tell them that I told you to do that, because I'll really get my... Just don't do that. Forget I even mentioned it, actually. So there. But we're really looking forward to AirVenture in a couple of weeks. I think there's an awful lot of pent-up demand that some of you got to experience down in Sun and Fun.
I just thought of how we could honor our good friend Launchpad. I see that 3 out of 4 of us here have mustaches. Rob, you're going to have to join in here. But I'm thinking we should see who can grow the best handlebar mustache to replace what is now missing, the characteristic. Now, maybe, if Launchpad were here, he would start a photo contest. So, yeah, all right, yeah. I think this is what we should do. Listeners, if you have a fine handlebar mustache and you've waxed the ends and it looks anything like a Launchpad, let's go ahead and have you submit them to the show. Max, how will they do that?
Just send them to the geeks at airplanegeeks.com. I think that's a really fun idea. I know that I will I won't be a very good competitor in a contest like that. Just call me Peach Fuzz. That's about it.
I think it would be impossible for me, because although I did have a mustache in my younger days. The night I asked Nancy to marry me, she said, I absolutely will. With one reservation, and she pointed to my mustache and she said, this has got to go.
Oh, gosh.
So unless I wanted to sleep with Archie, I don't think I'm going to be able to do it.
All right. And David, we're going to have a link to your the Arabic translation of your interview. Do you think this is going to be a trend with you showing up and in some of these foreign country news newscasts?
Well, I've for UAV Digest, I did Singaporean morning drive, So this now I've done Iraqi news. So if you're an obscure third world country or foreign nation and need a aviation expert, I'm your guy, evidently. So
I think some of the people who are listening that speak Arabic would do well to give us the straight scoop. Did the translators handle David's language accurately?
Hmm. Well, which is really kind of interesting. I mean, behind the scenes was it is an American produced show. So the producer was an American. The agent who contacted me was an American. However, once we went live, the host of the news program was Arabic. So I had a female Arabic translator in my ear, translating his question from Arabic to English. I was then giving my English answer to be translated back to Arabic, all simultaneously. It really was kind of a phenomenal, kind of interesting technical thing you got Arabic translated to English, response in English translated back to Arabic, all within less than a 30-second delay. So it really was quite interesting.
It would be nice to know what got lost in all those translations.
And I just see I have an email that just came in from Liechtenstein National News. They're asking for you, David.
I'm on it. Liechtenstein, though, that's Deutsch, so ich bin ein bisschen.
Yeah, but I figured you're looking for, the smallest country you could find to work with.
Oh, well, when I suddenly do the UAV Digest for the Vatican, that'll be great.
Vatican Digest News.
I was going to say Catholicsfordrones.com.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, David's email is okay.
All right. Hey, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Sergio Fukamati from SEI Industries. He's the aerial firefighting director. They, of course, make the Bambi bucket systems. And check out the show notes because there's some interesting links and videos and information surrounding that. Of course, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, we have a shortcut link, airplanegeeks.com/661. And you can reach us via email, as always, at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Max Trescott, any closing thoughts from you?
I had fun. And yes, let's bring Dan back sometime. folks can find me at the usual places. Go out to aviationnewstalk.com, or if you're interested in seeing some fun pictures, go to Instagram and follow Aviation News Talk.
And David, where can folks go if they can spell Vanderhoof?
Well, they can do that, you could always, if you're interested in the world of general aviation and airport life, you can always check out my Instagram at What Just Flew By, and where I post interesting aircraft that come into KOQN. And I will add a note. I'd like to send an email to our friend David, who runs liveatc.net, because Brandywine now is online at liveatc.net. And it's sponsored by the museum, the American Helicopter Museum. So
that's pretty cool.
We are actually, it is nice now that I can pump in the airports pattern and some noise to make it even more of a more a experience. And it was good to see Dave, our old friend, who I haven't seen in years, but it was good to see him. But yeah, and of course you can always, and I know that a lot of people have chimed in, reach us on our Slack listener team, and then you can do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com.
Great. And Rob Mark, where do we find you?
Well, same old places, flyingmag.com, jetwine.com for the blog. I do have an Instagram account at Jetwine, but I have been a little lax at keeping it up because we've been so busy at Flying Magazine. But hopefully it's going to be getting out to see people at AirVenture very soon in a couple – gosh, it's –
couple of
weeks. 2 weeks from Sunday as we record this. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I'll have Jetwine buttons. I'm going to put them all over my clothes so that people just can come up and just take one if
snatch
they want
them.
It.
That's just wrong on so many levels.
Okay. As I said, I will have Jetwine buttons available for those people that would like them. They can kindly ask, and I will pull one out of the bucket, or they can stick their own hand in, grab it out of the bucket. But none of that wacky stuff like, you know, David might suggest. So there you go. But hey, listen, very much. Thank you much for inviting me back. I'm really glad to have been here.
Always good to have you, Rob. Always good. And I look forward to seeing you at Oshkosh at AirVenture.
And Camp Bacon.
Be sure to swing by. Yeah, Camp Bacon. I've got a load of. I'm in Corning, New York, right now. I'm working my way towards Wisconsin, but I've got this big load of Airplane Geeks T-shirts and some other goodies. So come find me at Camp Bacon and score yourself some swag. Otherwise, you can find all the places where I am online at 30,000feet.com.
And Max, while you're in Corning, go visit the Corning Glass Museum.
I have my ticket.
Steuben Glass as well.
Yes, I have my tickets already. Going to do that tomorrow, probably.
Have fun.
So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Good night, everybody.
And thanks for listening.